Whenever my grandchildren ask me for a story, I always begin long ago and far away in the deep, dark forest. And even if there are dragons, ogres, bears, lions, evil knights, and great danger, the stories always end the same way. And they lived happily ever after. This is the After Dinner Scholar from Wyoming Catholic College, and I'm your host, Dr. Jim Tonkowicz. Happy endings have been standard fare in Western literature for millennia. Odysseus has many trials, but he finally gets home to Ithaca. Dante journeys through hell to get there, but in the end, he sees the beatific vision. Much later in literary history, Emma Woodhouse in Jane Austen's novel Emma and Elizabeth Bennet in her Pride and Prejudice suffer a variety of travails and setbacks, but in the end, they fall in love, marry well, and their happiness is complete. Unrealistic? Silly? Little more than one of those cheap romance novels? Or do happy endings in Jane Austen tell us something crucial about human nature, human desire, and the human condition? Dr. Tiffany Schubert teaches humanities and the trivium here at Wyoming Catholic College. Among her academic interests is the happy ending, and in that she focuses on Jane Austen. Dr. Schubert is our guest this week on the After Dinner Scholar. Dr. Schubert, how did you become interested in happy endings as something to study academically?
I fell in love with comedy as a genre in undergrad when my undergraduate professor presented it as the genre in which grace reigns. This idea that grace transforms the sorrow into joy. And so I've been interested in comedy for a long time, but comedy itself is notoriously difficult to talk about and define. And the happy ending is something that has not been addressed very much at all. So it seems like a way to think about the grace-filled genre of comedy from a really understudied scholarly aspect.
Yeah, and by comedy, you don't mean funny ha-ha.
That's right. Not exclusively. Comedy can certainly include humor, but we talk about the divine comedy, Dante's comedy, as a comedy, and there aren't many laugh-out-loud ha-ha moments in the Commedia. But the whole trajectory of the story is one of redemption and freedom, right? The movement of the soul from enslavement to sin to the freedom brought about by grace, and then finally that the final attainment of joy.
Mm-hmm. Now you've written, quote, "Our metaphysical assumptions shape the kind of narrative structure we deem realistic." Tell us what you mean by that.
So the way that we understand and define what reality is shapes our judgment, both in terms of creating a story, but also in thinking about a story and in how we consider that story to be realistic. So when we say things like, oh, that story wasn't very realistic, we have to be really careful and conscious of what we mean by realistic, what we mean by reality. Are we assuming there that reality is simply defined by the physical or the everyday or that which is accessible merely to the senses? Or do we include within our definition of reality that which exceeds the senses, the supernatural, the extraordinary, the immaterial? If those things are part of reality, then that's going to shape our judgment of stories. It's also going to shape the kinds of stories that we think it's possible to tell.
Mm-hmm. So you need grace to really understand comedy.
That's right. And we don't have to get into dense theological waters in terms of thinking about grace either. It doesn't have to be exclusively a Christian concept or any kind of particular sectarian understanding of grace, but simply right, the idea that a character cannot exclusively through his or her own means rescue themselves. They need some kind of outside, often, but not always, supernatural intervention to bring them to a state of full joy.
Now some, I suspect even some Christians, might say that happy endings are kind of contrived and sort of childish. I mean, it's a good ending for a fairy tale, not for adult stories so much. We already know better than happy endings. How would you respond to that?
Yeah, that's such a common understanding of the happy endings, even amongst people who share or whose metaphysical assumptions wouldn't necessarily lead them to deny the happy ending. My response would be that there's a universal desire for happiness, and that is a desire that transcends periods and transcends religion as well. All people want to be happy. And so because this is such a universal desire, I think it's really important for us to reflect on the nature of that desire. Like, it actually, I think it would be naive for us not to reflect on the nature of that desire. It would be a sort of a ridiculous thing to decide to not attend to something so universal. The happy ending can actually help us imaginatively think through and participate in that desire by giving us an experience of true happiness, instruct us in how true happiness feels, what true happiness is like. And that's, though potentially dangerous, I think ultimately can be extremely helpful for us thinking about our own desire for happiness, helping us to understand our own desire and then live life well with that desire.
Well, let's focus on Jane Austen. What was she communicating in her novels, all of which I believe have happy endings? What was she telling us about life?
That's right. Yes, she was. And Jane Austen is certainly aware of the unfairy tale-like elements in human life. She's aware of the fact that marriages go badly and people make stupid mistakes that have very serious consequences. So she does not live in this prettified world in which things just sort of work out. At the same time, though, that she sees this profound connection between virtue and happiness, and she wants to communicate that clearly to her audience. She wants to awaken in her audience both the desire for virtue and the desire for the happiness that comes about as a result of that virtue. So the happiest marriages that we see in Jane Austen are this union of lovers who are both, there are many things, extremely, extremely intelligent, extremely virtuous people, though they've grown into their virtue. They've struggled and they've failed, but they have become more virtuous, and that virtue actually allows them to be happier than the characters who don't have that virtue. And so when she communicates her happy endings, she's not simply stepping in and saying, things were bad, these people were messed up, and then here we go, now they're happy, but that there is this intimate connection between the virtue that one comes to and the happiness that one can find.
Yeah, because not everybody has a happy ending in her novels.
No, that's right. Some people are sort of neutral. They stay in a kind of stasis. They're in mediocre marriages, mediocre characters. Some, not many, are in a way punished, but with profound unhappiness. But for the most part, Jane Austen is so much of the right an author of the everyday life that she's not going to give us extreme visions of people in intense tragic suffering, but clarifying to us that these people are not as happy as the lovers, as her ideal lovers. And there is an idealizing quality to the happiness that she presents.
Well, could you give us some examples from the novels?
So at the very end of Emma, we are told that the small band of friends that surrounds Emma and Mr. Knightley, who are the main lovers from that novel, they have perfect confidence in the perfect happiness of the union. We're moderns, we're savvy enough, we know no one has perfect happiness. That sets us on edge. But Austen is presenting Emma and Mr. Knightley as having a perfect union. So there's something ideal in their love. That doesn't have to mean that it's unreal, though. You can have an ideal held up before you, presented before you, without it being an unreal thing. Both of those lovers have made mistakes. Emma in particular, very serious mistake. She keeps making mistakes throughout the whole of the novel. And she's grown in virtue and she's come to self-knowledge. And even at the end, we know that she's not perfect. And yet you get this perfect, the perfect happiness of their marriage.
And Jane Austen knows it isn't perfect either, right?
That's right. She knows it's not perfect in the sense of, she knows that no human relationship is going to be without occasional tension and occasional frustrations. She's never trying to deny that element. But she sees them as ideally suited for each other, and also, I think, as a model for the reader, to direct the reader's desire. Or she's interested in what type of happiness should a reader want. And I, Jane Austen, want the reader to want this kind of happiness, this perfect happiness that, say, Mr. Knightley or Emma have, or Elizabeth and Darcy have. And so she's going to work to awaken the reader's desire for that happiness. Mm-hmm. She has a didactic purpose.
I think you've already kind of answered this, but how is reading Jane Austen an emotional and moral education for the reader?
So Jane Austen herself was a great reader of novels. She loved the novel. She loved the novel of her own day. But she saw in the novel a tendency to depict characters, particularly women, as paragons of perfection. She declares rather famously in a letter that those paragons of perfection make her sick and wicked. So she realizes this is a very real psychological effect, that seeing, you know, beholding a too perfect character actually does not inspire someone to virtue. So what she decides to do is present us with these morally flawed characters who grow into their happiness. So she's trying to teach her audience about the nature of virtue, just like these other authors with their perfect heroines who are always doing the virtuous thing all the time. She's also trying to teach her audience about virtue, but she realizes it's much more effective to teach people about virtue if you show someone stumbling and then growing. And so that's part of the moral reformation. It's also part of the emotional reformation too, or formation of the reader. We actually, as readers, our love is awakened. In general, when we see a character, a good character who also is flawed, or perhaps where we see ourselves, perhaps because it's the most common kind of type of person, a complex person, right? A nuanced person who's not simplistically evil, but also not just simplistically good. And so we respond to that. And so then when we see that kind of person growing, it awakens our desire for that growth, rather than repelling us as like this, yeah, this the perfect heroine would. And then especially, and Austen does such a good job of this, of making us fall in love with her characters. I challenge anyone to read Pride and Prejudice and not fall in love with Elizabeth Bennet. She's just so incredibly lovable, in part because she's flawed. She stumbles and she grows. So we fall in love with these characters, and then we desire happiness for them. But not any kind of happiness. This happiness that is intimately connected to Austen's profound sense of virtue.
Near the end of Pride and Prejudice, Elizabeth Bennet, who is finally engaged to Mr. Darcy, writes in a letter, "I am the happiest creature in the world. Perhaps other people have said so before, but not one with such justice." And we as readers smile, hoping that it's true. True for Elizabeth, and true for us as well, perhaps. For Wyoming Catholic College, this is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz.